Part 9. History repeats itself, first as tragedy, second as farce. Karl Marx. Ready for a fight.
Tight enough,
gasped Savine, fists clenched on the table, and she heard Fried grunt with effort as she knotted the laces. Someone had daubed the words, "We will burn the past," above the fireplace and taken an axe to the wallpaper, but as prison cells went, she supposed it could have been a great deal worse. A room in the palace where some minor visiting dignitary could have gently aged as they waited on His Majesty's pleasure. One could almost have mistaken it for the dressing chamber of a lady of fashion, except for the crooked bars bodged into the window frames and the sense of barely contained mortal terror. They had given her good food and clean linen. They had given her matching cribs in which Harrod and Ardy snored, blissfully unaware of the danger they were in. They had supplied her with all the soaps and scents, powders and paints, wigs and dresses, the most exacting socialite might need for a grand public appearance. They had even sent for her old maids Fried and Metello to help her prepare. It reminded Savine a little of happier times before she was a lady governor, before she betrayed the king, before the great change came. Except that Lisbeth was dead and Zuri was in prison. She winced at that thought. They tortured people suspected of hoarding flour. What might they do to someone accused of being a flesh-eating sorcerer in the service of the prophet? Harun and Rabik, too, who had followed her so faithfully. Had their loyalty landed them in fathoms of chain? It was insane. It was laughable. But in the current climate, the insane and laughable could quickly turn fatal. Savine closed her eyes and took a shuddering breath. She had charges of her own to answer, some almost as insane and laughable as those against Zuri and her brothers, others all too horribly true. She had to fight for herself first. If they found her guilty, she could help no one.
This one?
Asked Metello in her thick Styrian accent. She had a dress over one arm, a great swag of bright blue Suljuk silk with Osprian lace at the cuffs and embroidered flowers all around the hem. It had been made for an appearance at the theatre, she thought, but never worn. That colour had always seemed to be trying too hard. Savine waved it away.
By the fates, no.
Judge hoped to swindle her with good treatment, to put her off guard with familiar luxuries, to coax her into appearing at the trial as her old self, the personification of the ruthless, exploitative, privileged elite that the great change had set out to destroy. She had even furnished Savine with jewels, some excellent earrings and a very fine ruby necklace, no doubt taken as bribes from some ex-lord's wife in return for a pardon that never came. Judge did not really do pardons, not even for rubies as fine as these. Savine put a finger under them and held them to the light, admiring their bloody sparkle. Then she slid the stand firmly away. Judge might very well be sending her to the Tower of Chains, but she was a damn fool if she thought Savine would be helping.
Let's keep it very simple, ladies, very clean and very humble. No jewels and no wig.
Metello gave an upset cluck, frowning at Savine's own fuzz of clipped brown hair. No silk and no... There was a crash outside, and Savine spun towards the door, took a lurching step for the children, one hand pressed to her churning stomach, the other reaching for the cribs. From a practical point of view, quite apart from the agony of producing them and the permanent damage they had done to her body, her babies were nothing but an almighty annoyance. Nipple-chewing, dung-leaking, sleep-killing monsters with no conversation at all. But she was even more terrified for them than for herself. Laughter beyond the door, another crash, then cheery voices burbling off into silence. Just the burners, doing what burners do.
Savine forced the panic away, forced her clutching hand down, then turned in surprise at a great sob. Fried stood with her face screwed up, shoulders shaking. "Whatever is it?" demanded Savine. If anyone should have been weeping, she rather thought she had the best claim. She had scarcely slept since they arrested her. It felt as if only the savagely laced corsetry was keeping her standing.
"When all this happened, the great change, I mean,"
Fried's bottom lip trembled, then she blurted it out.
"I thought it might be a good thing. It seemed to be, for a while, freedom and all, and folk so happy. But then,"
she stared into the corner, eyes brimming,
"but then, by the fates, my lady, forgive me."
Savine's first impulse was to slap her. She knew she would be lucky to see sunset and did not particularly want to spend the hours she had left soothing a wardrobe maid's regrets. How she missed Zuri. She had never cried, even when they dragged her away in a muzzle. But we must work with the tools we have, as Savine's father had been so fond of saying. She forced down her anger and put a gentle hand on Fried's shoulder. "There is nothing to forgive," she said with an effort. "Perhaps it could have been a good thing, should have been. And I am not a lady any more, just plain citizeness. That is what I need people to see." Fried sniffed back her tears and picked up the powder.
"I'll cover up your scar."
"No," said Savine, looking at it in the mirror, running pink and crooked up her forehead and into her clipped hair. "Get the blusher. Bring it out a little. Let them see that I know what pain is. We never met, Savine Dan Glockter, terror of the salons, you understand? Have them put the darling of the slums on trial."
"So?"
asked Metello, holding up one of her nursing dresses, plain white.
"Perfect."
A clonking knock on the door brought another surge of sick terror.
"It's gone abroad," came the rough voice from outside.
"Should I tell him you're dressing?"
whispered Fried. Savine pressed on her stomach again, smothered the fear again. One advantage of facing your death was that modesty did not seem so heavy a consideration. She raised her voice so it could be well understood beyond the door. "Gunnar Broad saved my life in Valbeck after I was chased half naked by a mob, Fried. I doubt the sight of my petticoat will scandalize him, and he's got the key after all." The doorknob turned and the door swung open, leaving Broad framed in the doorway, huge, armored, red-eyed. He took a heavy step into the room. He frowned towards the children. He frowned towards Fried, and she shrank behind the dressing table. He frowned towards Savine. He looked ill, drunk, furious, and sentimental all at once. The definitive burner, in fact. As if he couldn't decide whether to beg her forgiveness or smash her face in.
"You've got 1 hour,"
he said, turning back towards the door.
"I appreciate the reminder. And I have something for you."
Savine held the folded paper out to him.
"From Liddy."
His slack face twitched at the name.
"Liddy can't write."
"I suppose May must have written it. It came with some dispatches from Leo's mother."
Broad's jaw worked, his bloodshot eyes fixed on the letter, his hand halfway towards it.
"What does it say?"
"Don't be ridiculous, Gunnar. I don't read letters that aren't addressed to me. Honestly, you'll be telling me Zuri eats people next."
She pressed the letter carelessly into his hand and turned back to her powder, but she studied him in the mirror. He stared down at that paper for a long moment, then walked very slowly to the door and pulled it very slowly shut. Savine clenched her jaw and made a trembling fist. She might be going off the Tower of Chains. The fates knew the odds were against her, but she would not be going without a fight. Fried was over one of the cribs, cooing gently to Harrod.
"Do you want me to take the children?
Her eyes were getting moist again.
I mean, when they put you in the dock.
I may need you to take them. Savine lost her voice for a moment, had to clear her throat. When I am condemned. It was better to say when than if. She did not dare to say if. Until that moment, in the court, in the dock, they come with me. This was not a trial, it was a show, and Savine knew how to put on a show. No one better. Adua was hidden behind a rise, but you could see the great shadow of its smoke from miles around. The furnaces are still lit, said Durand. No matter how you try, murmured Leo, you can't stop progress. Lord Marshal Forrest squinted up at the sun, providing some actual warmth for what felt like the first time in months.
Don't like marching in the open like this.
If you can call it marching. The drums were beating double time, but the demoralized remains of the People's Army and the exhausted remnants of the Crown Prince's division moved at a trudge. Their ranks dissolved into a shambling mass, flags limp and pole arms drooping, a trail of mud and rubbish in their wake. A giant military slug squirming spent across the damp country.
They hardly look ready for a fight.
They're not, said Glaward.
We've lost more deserters without fighting than we'd ever have lost casualties if we had.
Leo looked to the few well-drilled blocks of dark-uniformed cavalry towards the front.
At least we can rely on the Anglanders.
They're with you to the death, said Durand.
Glaward clapped a heavy hand on Leo's shoulder.
And so are we.
For a fond moment, it felt almost like old times. Forrest was fretting at his frayed cuffs as he stared towards that smear on the sky.
They must know we're coming.
They believe we're killing each other miles away, said Leo. And Inspector Teufel is making sure the People's Inspectorate won't be putting anyone straight on that score.
You trust her?
Asked Forrest.
No, said Leo. But trust is a poor foundation for an alliance. I've found, to my cost, the woman's damned effective.
Even so, you can't keep thousands of soldiers secret for long.
Who's this?
Glaward spurred in front of Leo, hand on his sword. A couple of Forrest scouts were leading a dishevelled horse by the bridle, a dishevelled prisoner in the saddle, with hands tied behind him.
Caught this article on the road ahead, Lord Marshal,
one of them called out.
Caught me? Squawked the prisoner. I was bloody trying to find you. I've a message from Corporal Tunney.
Forrest grinned.
That article's called Yoke, and I'm sorry to say he's on our side. Let him free.
Once he had his hands back, the man gave a slovenly salute.
It's Lord Brock I need to speak to. I mean to say, are you lords again now? It's all out with it, snapped Leo. It's your wife. She's, well, there's no easy way to say it.
Take the hard way, then.
They've arrested her. Judge is putting her on trial for profiteering and treason and,
Yoke swallowed.
Well, incest, gotta mention.
Silence. Behind them, the drums and the tramping boots and the clatter of gear went on. Leo wondered how he ought to feel, would be expected to feel. He bunched his good hand into a fist.
When? Today. The king will be there. Hell, half the city will be there. It's set to be the biggest execution since Risenow went off the tower. That is to say,
we'll get there in time, said Durand. Don't worry, we'll get there.
I know, muttered Leo.
It was terrible news, of course. His wife was in danger, his children. He made sure everyone could see how deeply he felt it. Terrible news. But he couldn't help seeing an upside. The burners would be distracted. It might give them an opening. Forrest nudged his mount close.
Listen, young lion, I sympathize, but you can't let this get in the way. His Majesty's safety has to come first.
They'll both be at the court of the people, said Leo.
save one, we save the other.
Durand frowned back towards the sleepwalking soldiers. We'll save no one limping along like this.
Agreed, said Forrest.
If I learned one thing at Stauffenbeck, said Leo, it's that you'll do no good with bad men. Lord Marshal, I suggest you pick out 200 men you fully trust, the best armed and mounted, your most loyal. When we make it through Arnold's Wall.
If we make it.
When we make it, Glarwood and your officers can spread the rest out through Adua. Secure the gates, the docks, the bridges, the squares, and crossroads. Hold down the city for its own safety. We'll rush my best men and yours straight for the Agriant and take the south gate. Free the king before they know we're coming.
Forrest grimly nodded.
And your wife, too.
Leo frowned towards the great pall of smoke on the horizon. Could he see the pinpricks of Adua's tallest towers peeking over the grassy rise? The house of the Maker, the highest chimneys, perhaps even the roof of the Tower of Chains.
And my wife, too.
Savine would understand. She used to love a gamble, after all.
Tight enough,
squeaked Gorst, and Vic pulled the strap through the buckle and gave his back plate a thump with her fist. Felt like the right thing to do when helping a man on with his armour. Not that she'd know. Helping men in and out of their clothes was something she'd done less than she'd have liked down the years.
Brock and Forrest are on their way, she said.
Will they get here in time?
Vic could only shrug. No idea how long they'd take to get to the city. No idea what resistance they'd face once they got in. No idea how long the trial might last. Far too many variables, all way outside her control. While Gorst slid his mirror-polished steels into their sheaths, she pushed the squares board aside and spread out the map, staring at it, as if some answer might suddenly reveal itself in invisible ink.
I bought off the guards at the gates in Casimir's Wall and Arnold's. With any luck, our friends can march straight through. The gate of the Agriant is the problem.
And she tapped at the citadel's south gate, always the weakest point in a weak plan. They blew up some bits of the wall, but not enough to make a difference. And Judge has her most loyal men guarding it. Too risky to bribe. The paranoid bastards took all the gates off the hinges, but the portcullises are still mounted. They drop those, our friends will be stuck outside. Might take them days to get in, if they get in at all.
So?
We have to take the chain room.
We?
You and me. I spin the guards a story about worries over their loyalty, try to get at least a couple out, then we deal with the rest. We bar the door. We hold it till the young lion's cavalry arrives.
Gorst nodded slowly. He didn't say whether he thought it was a good plan or a bad. He didn't have to. Vic already knew it was a terrible plan. She just hadn't been able to think of a better one.
Timing'll be tight, she murmured, taking the neat row of weapons from the table one by one and sliding them into their various sheaths, pockets, hiding places. Go too late, they'll be ready. No way we'll capture the room. Go too early, even if we capture the room, we might have lost it by the time Brock gets there.
She thought about that a moment. And we'll probably be dead. Gorst had shaved his head again, and he ran a hand over the silvery stubble on his scalp with a faint hissing.
How many men?
The usual detail, Vic licked her lips, is 8.
Gorst made no comment. She doubted he'd have flinched if she'd said 1,000.
That seem a lot to you? She asked.
It is what it is. Are you willing to kill?
Hearing it like that, so blunt and brutal, made her wonder.
I understand the stakes, she said, slapping her dagger into her boot sheath. I'll do what needs doing, if you can handle the other 7.
She'd meant it as a joke, but he didn't smile.
Fewer would be better.
The fact was, with only the 2 of them, this wouldn't be easy. She could have asked Tallow along, but she told herself he'd only get in the way. She could have hired men, but there was no one she trusted.
Story of my life, she muttered under her breath.
Too much trust could kill you in a heartbeat. She'd learned that lesson in the camps, learned it too well, maybe, because now it seemed too little trust could kill you just as dead. Only it happened slowly, during years spent alone and looking over your shoulder. Still, if you could only bring one man to a fight with the future of the Union hanging on the outcome, she reckoned Bremer Dan Gorst a good pick. He pulled the constable's greatcoat on with some difficulty. The biggest one she'd been able to find, and still he was close to ripping it at the shoulders, breastplate glinting above the top button, lumps of his many weapons clearly showing.
I have never been subtle, he said sheepishly.
With any luck, folk will be looking elsewhere. Vic shoved the mace through her belt, and she was ready. I hear Judge means to make a show of this one.